My name is Jonathan Blackwood. Welcome to My Tech Decisions Podcast. Today's guest is Jason McNew, founder and CEO of Stronghold Cybersecurity. Jason and I speak about all kinds of considerations around cybersecurity, including the importance of developing cyber emergency responses the way companies develop fire drills.
Let me give you a short example. Let's say, for instance, right now that you're in some office environment, doesn't matter what it is, and the fire drill goes off, right? Everybody knows exactly what to do. Now, let's say you ask any one of those people, let's say that you get ransomware in your machine right now, what should you do? Most of them are going to say, well, I don't know.
As well as how to justify purchasing cybersecurity technology to key stakeholders outside of the IT department.
They want to see things expressed in terms of risk management and then dollars and cents.
I had Jason on the show because there may be few people to better speak to the subject of cybersecurity and working with IT providers to implement cybersecurity into an organization than Jason. Jason McNew is a United States Air Force veteran with over 20 years of experience in the field of information technology, including 12 years at the White House Communications Agency and Camp David, where he worked on some of the most secure systems in the world for some of the most important customers in the world. When he was at the White House, Jason held what is known as a Yankee White security clearance. The Yankee White is an elite clearance granted to only those of unquestionable character and integrity. In addition to being a member of numerous security-focused professional organizations, Jason is also CISSP, CCNA, and ITIL certified. So it's safe to say that Jason understands the importance of keeping digital information safe. He brings a governmental approach to cybersecurity regardless of the organization. So Jason and I speak about the considerations of cybersecurity for the commercial end user. And he outlines the importance of having a cybersecurity plan, testing as often as possible, following the right guidelines. And we also go in depth into what end users should include in an RFP when building or enhancing their cybersecurity portfolio. Jason stresses the importance of being upfront, revealing the good, the bad, and the ugly of your system and services after signing a non-disclosure agreement, of course, and being clear about the IT provider's role in training and developing these drills for the whole company on cybersecurity best practices. Pay close attention to this interview because Jason gives you a better understanding of the necessities of cybersecurity for any organization, and you'll be equipped to include all of the information you need in a request for a proposal and discussions with your IT provider when you're ready for your next cybersecurity project. I'll let Jason fill you in on the specifics. Enjoy. Before we get to the interview, a quick reminder that My Tech Decisions podcast is now available on iTunes and the Google Play Store. Make sure to subscribe in order to instantly download the latest interviews with expert AV integrators, IT providers, security installers, technology manufacturers, and commercial technology decision makers like yourself. If you like what you hear, you can leave a comment and rate the podcast as well. Search for My Tech Decisions podcast on iTunes and the Google Play Store. Download and subscribe. Now let's get to the interview. Welcome to My Tech Decisions podcast. Today's guest is Jason McNew, founder and CEO of Stronghold Cybersecurity. Jason, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan.
No problem at all. Jason has an extensive background in IT and in fact has worked with the White House. Is that correct?
White House Communications Agency, yes.
Okay, tell me a little bit about that.
I landed in the White House Communications Agency as part of a volunteer effort that was run through the Air National Guard. When you're in the National Guard, you see a lot of really interesting volunteer opportunities that come through there, and some of them are really high speed. You'll see things to go to the South Pole or to do things in Europe, and in this particular case, I saw a volunteer opportunity for a six-month tour at the White House Communications Agency when I was in the National Guard assigned out in Pittsburgh. So I asked my commander at the time to help me apply for it. So I filled out a lot of paperwork. I went through a bunch of interviews, a couple of phone calls, and it was a very stringent interview process. And that 180-day tour that I was supposed to get turned into a year, and that turned into a year and a half. And then after I'd been there for a year and a half, it happened that an IT position had opened up at Camp David. And I'd already been there many times, and I, you know, was familiar with the leadership and the processes and stuff. And they asked me, well, do you want this job at Camp David? And that's, you know, kind of hard to say no to. So I accepted the position at Camp David, and I was up there for 10 years. So I spent a lot of time in these really secure facilities where, you know, buildings have no windows and you're surrounded by people with machine guns and you can't take your cell phones in. And, you know, just extreme security was kind of the environment that I worked in for a long time. So that's kind of what I'm very used to.
Yeah, and that extended to the digital world as well. I can imagine that places like the White House and Camp David have to be extremely secure as far as cybersecurity goes. And that's the reason that we wanted to have Jason on the program. Who better to speak about the needs of cybersecurity for IT departments than someone who was involved in probably some of the most secure environments around. So kind of going off of that, and really for, you know, regular organizations, enterprise, schools, hospitals, things of the like, give us your interpretation of what cybersecurity is and what that means for the end user and IT personnel.
Well, cybersecurity, I think when people talk about cybersecurity, they tend to focus too much on technology. And technology, to me, is kind of like a moat, but it's the people and your policies that really make the castle. And I say that a lot. And when you work in highly secure environments, places like, and I've been to a lot of them, not just the White House, not just the Camp David, a bunch of other facilities that I can't even really get into. I was watching a video on YouTube the other day, and they were talking about the 10 forbidden places that you could never go, and I'd realize I'd been to three of them. It's kind of an eye-opener. But when you go to places like that, what you see is a very mature security culture, right? And I like to compare the security culture to a safety culture. If you go into any small business today, or imagine yourself going to Home Depot or an amusement park or anything, and then just take note of all the safety things you'll see. You'll see safety cones and fire signs and people wearing hard hats and, you know, safety vests and all these other things. And we're so used to that we don't even think of it anymore, right? All of our businesses, they have a culture of security, or a culture of safety, rather. Which is mandated by OSHA, by the way. Everybody has to have that. They're mandated to. Now, when you go into these highly secure places, in addition to all that safety stuff, they also have a very mature culture of security. So when you go into the break room, or you're walking down the halls, next to all those safety posters, you're going to see a lot of security posters. And in addition to the safety drills that we all do, you know, we do security drills all the time as well. So I think it's not just a technology issue that the small businesses, a lot of the technology is actually pretty good, but they really need to be training their people. And let me give you a short example. Let's say, for instance, right now that you're in some office environment, doesn't matter what it is, and the fire drill goes off, right? Everybody knows exactly what to do. They're going to lock their computers quick. They're going to stand up. They know where the fire exit is, and they're all going to muster at some point. And then they're going to take a head count. We all know that because we're drilled on it. Now, let's say you ask any one of those people, okay, let's say that you get ransomware in your machine right now. What should you do? Most of them are going to say, well, I don't know, you know. And from a military perspective, from a government perspective, the way that we train people, their answer should be, well, disconnect the computer from the network immediately. Don't turn it off. And then notify the security manager. So people are trained to that level in these places with advanced security environments. So again, the cybersecurity is not just the technology like firewalls, endpoint protection, IDSs, and those sorts of things. We need to be training people. We need to have the right people in the right places with the right job roles. People need to know who their security manager is, and they have to be trained, you know, on a recurring basis. Does that make sense, Jonathan?
Yeah, I think it makes a ton of sense, and I really do. I agree with you. I think that organizations that aren't necessarily in that security space all the time. Definitely don't do things like fire drills for cybersecurity purposes. And I definitely want to get into that. But you mentioned that it's not all about the technology, but there's definitely technology involved. What would be, you know, more or less your checklist for any medium-sized small businesses or universities or even some of the largest ones? What are some of the technologies that you would say, you know, you need to have this and then you might also want to have this?
Well, let's go into the, you might also want to have this. That's an interesting question, right? I think if you ask any IT staffer, they know that they have to have some type of a firewall with deep packet inspection, possibly SSL inspection. They need to have an intrusion detection system. They need to have advanced endpoint protection. As far as endpoint protection goes, by the way, I happen to agree with, there's a handful of companies out there like SentinelOne and Cylance that are selling behavior-based endpoint protection. And I think the traditional antivirus is dead. Signature-based antivirus is dead. It's just a whack-a-mole strategy. I don't think it works anymore. And again, it's one part of a defense in depth strategy. But beyond all of the technology, one of the things that I think that companies can be looking at is IPv6, which is a steep hill to climb. But IPv6 has a lot of security features built directly into it. And on top of that, a lot of the malware is designed to propagate over IPv4, especially the script kiddie stuff, the automated garbage. That's really not designed to work with IPv6, but it is designed to work with IPv4. So any enterprise, as far as their long-term security strategy goes, for their internal networks, they should probably be thinking about implementing IPv6. And that's going to put them ahead of the curve. For now, but what's going to happen is eventually the threat actors are going to start developing logic, malicious logic that deals with the IPv6.
You mentioned that you need these technologies. Now, anyone in an IT department has probably experienced the time where you're talking to someone who is not involved in IT and you're trying to explain to them how important something is and they just don't get it, especially if that something is expensive. Can you give end users sort of a pitch to their, you know, CFO, for example, or something of the like that says, you know, this is how you want to communicate your needs to the layman, more or less?
Well, sure. Here's and whenever you write anything or you're speaking or whatever, you have to think about who your audience is, right? And if you're going to talk to a CFO, and my dad was a CPA and his brother was a CFO, so I, you know, can certainly speak to that type of mentality. But they want to see things expressed in terms of risk management and then dollars and cents. And when you start getting into the higher level security certifications like the CISSP, the Cybersecurity Common Body of Knowledge, so to speak, contains multiple equations which are designed exactly for that purpose. You're going to be looking at things like annual rate of occurrence and exposure factor and, you know, asset value and those sorts of things. But what a CFO is going to want to know, they want to know, okay, so you want to implement this control, Mr. IT guy, that sounds great. How much does it cost? And how much is it going to save me in the event of some type of a breach? So, and again, like I said, cybersecurity as a discipline is more about risk management than anything. So, security is a cost center for 99.99% of businesses. So security only makes sense to the extent that it reduces business risk to the business in some shape or form, or it saves money. So when you're dealing with the C-suite or the CEO, you have to look at some of the financial equations that the CISSP and some of the other certifications teach and then plug your data into those. And then once you show a CFO, okay, well, hypothetically, let's say that we have a PII breach of, you know, 10,000 records. It's going to cost us $1 million. We expect that to happen, for instance, once every 15 years or something like that. So then you have an idea of what, you know, the single loss expectancy is. But if we implement some type of control in order to mitigate this, it's going to cost X dollars. And then at the end of this equation, and the equations aren't that difficult, what you're going to have is some type of an ROI. And if you could show that the ROI is positive, then the C-suite folks should respond to that. And if the ROI is not positive, then, you know, maybe it makes sense to not mitigate or just accept the risk or transfer the risk. Or, you know, you might want to just take some asset and then turn it off. There's a lot of different ways to manage risk.
Now we've you know, used those equations, we've gotten buy-in from the C-suite, and now we're ready to reach out to a service provider with an RFP. Building cybersecurity into an RFP, what are some of the do's and don'ts? What should you communicate? And going back to your earlier point, should you include anything about possible training exercises or education of the staff in that RFP, or is that something that you want to do after the fact?
Yes, yes, and yes. Security needs to be baked into all of your business processes. You can't bolt it on after the fact, otherwise it's going to leave you vulnerable. And we're talking about one of the things that kind of concerns me. Keep in mind that the entire tech sector and the cybersecurity space is completely unregulated, right? Which is great. We're the only sector of the economy that makes everything better, faster, and cheaper on a year-over-year basis. I often say this jokingly, but if the tech sector ran healthcare, then a heart transplant would cost $49.95, or maybe three payments of $49.95 or something. I don't know, right? So the tech sector, we've gotten to the point, you have an iPhone or some type of a smartphone in your pocket, right? It's got a quad-core processor. There's so many transistors in that thing that 30 or 40 years ago, that many transistors would have taken up a couple of city blocks. And the tech sector has taken this technology that 40, 50 years ago was science fiction, and we've made it available to people that live below the poverty line, right? You could walk into an Apple store, a Verizon store, whatever, cough up a few bucks, sign in the line, and then walk out with what is a supercomputer, even if you live below the poverty line. The tech sector does that, okay? Now, the downside is that the tech sector is completely unregulated, so there's nothing to stop, hypothetically speaking, a tattoo parlor from selling cybersecurity, right? You could do that. You have to get a license to give tattoos. You have to get a license to cut nails. You have to have a license to bake cookies, right? All these other things. But you don't need any kind of a government-sanctioned license in order to sell cybersecurity or IT. So the onus is on the purchasing agent or body or customer. They have to do their due diligence and exercise their due care to make sure that whoever they're purchasing their services from are very qualified to do it, and that they understand the concept of risk management, and that they're not just going to sell them boxes, because I see a lot of that happening, especially in the, you know, with the marketing aspects of IT. There's a lot of push for solutions, quote unquote, which are just boxes and generate MRR, monthly recurring revenue. Monthly recurring revenue is great. We all want to make money, but just selling people technology, you know, firewalls, endpoint protection, things that we make money on every single month, is not necessarily going to solve their problem. So we need to make sure that we're looking at cybersecurity holistically. You have to have, and I compare it in a way, if you've seen Marcus Lemonis's show, The Profit, right? He talks about people, process, and product. And I think that there's some parallels to cybersecurity there. And what I mean is that with people, you have to have the right people in the right place, right? If you go to Home Depot and you ask somebody, who's your safety manager? They're going to say, oh, it's Steve. We know who the safety manager is, right? But if you go into any other enterprise and say, well, who's your security manager? Or who's the security monitor? Go, I don't know, right? So they don't know. So A, you have to have a security manager, some person that's assigned to that role. And then B, everybody knows, has to know, you know, who that person is. And you might have some kind of a hierarchy. You might have an, you know, an analyst and an engineer and then a manager. So you have to have people in those roles. They have to have corresponding education and certification. And then all the people in your enterprise have to know who these people are. And then back to the Marcus Lemonis analogy again, process would be akin to all of your policies, right? You have to have security policies. And the policies, they have to start with the C-suite. They have to have buy-in from the executive team, and they have to be baked into all of your business processes. It has to be part of your entire business, that culture of security. And then product, I suppose, is kind of like technology. Yeah, you're going to have, you know, Cisco ASA or SonicWall or Deep Packet Inspection, or you might have SentinelOne on your endpoints or Cylance or something like that, McAfee. There's tons of different technologies out there that you can use to manage different problems. So, again, like I said, cybersecurity is a holistic type of practice, and it's not just about technology. I would say Probably maybe 50% of it is technology, and the remaining 50% is training, and your people and your policies.
So then for end users that are looking to create an RFP, obviously it sounds like the most crucial step is identifying who you want to send that RFP out to. And obviously you're going to send it to, you know, two or three different companies. But when you're narrowing down that companies, as you mentioned, if it's an unregulated sector, then what can end users look for that will let them know this is a partner that I can work with long term that will have my best interest at heart? Are there any certifications that they should look for? Is it just, you know, reaching out to other clients that have worked with these companies? Are there any resources that they can use that will give a little bit more justification to different providers that they could eventually go with?
Well, let me tell you, in the space that I came from, in the DoD space and the government space, we have a directive called 8570, right? DoD 8570. And everybody that works for the DoD knows what 8570 is. And 8570 is short, and it's basically a short matrix that maps three different levels of competency to three different levels of certification. So you'll have, Tech 1 would map to, well, you have IAT level 1, IAT level 2, and then IAT level 3. So you have kind of like an analyst, an engineer, and then a manager. And then these three different levels, they map to, 8570 is vendor agnostic, and it maps to certifications from a bunch of different vendors, right? The DoD doesn't want to be in the business, at least they try not to anyway, so they sometimes do anyway, of pushing one particular vendor. So there's certifications in here from SANS, there's certifications in here from IC squared that map to these 1, 2, and 3. So there's a whole bunch of different certifications you could get to meet these basic certification requirements. And I suspect that if the tech sector becomes regulated, which I'm opposed to, even though it would benefit me, that the licensing will look somewhat like this 8570 that the DoD has had for several years. So this is a resource that I like, but you need to make sure that your people are certified to practice cybersecurity, and cybersecurity is a specialty, and it really goes beyond IT. And the main objective of it, again, is to manage risk. So whoever you're hiring to secure your enterprise, that's the verbiage you really need to be hearing, is what they're doing to manage your risk. So when you talk to them, when you make those first phone calls and you start vetting them, that's the kind of language you want to be hearing, is risk management, not just, oh, we're going to install firewalls and endpoint protection and all these other things that, you know, just generate monthly recurring revenue. Because the objective of cybersecurity, again, like I was saying, is to reduce business risk or save money. So you want to hear them talking about managing risk, and then you want to hear them talking about some of these certifications, either from SANS or from IC squared or GIAC. There's a whole bunch of them.
Yeah. So it sounds like once you sort of vet and choose your partner, it wouldn't be as much about saying, okay, we want these technologies. It would be about saying, we want these capabilities, or we want this level of security. So when creating that RFP, you know, you as a service provider, what is the most helpful for you? What information can they give right off the bat that will, you know, start you as far ahead of the starting line as possible?
You know, to me, at the end of the day, what I really need to know is, When I worked at the White House Communications Agency in Camp David, and I was a member of the military, the question always is, what's the mission? What's the objective, right? So the first thing that I need to know when I talk to a business owner is, well, what is it that you do for your own customers? You know what I mean? Because all of their concerns are going to stem from, you know, providing service to their own customers, whatever is their mission is that they do. You know, they might be a retailer, they might be selling something, they might be a nonprofit, they could be a healthcare provider. So I need to understand what it is that they do, and we need to have some type of an idea about their enterprise. You know, how is it organized? I mean, it could be a C corp, it could be an S corp, it could be an LLC, it could be, you know, privately held, or any of those things. So before you even talk about managing risk, you need to understand the organization first and what its mission is, and how it's currently structured, what kind of policies they have. That's the first question, definitely.
Okay, and then moving on from that, how much do you need to know upfront about their network or their current cybersecurity initiatives, things like that?
Everything and anything. So once we understand the organization, the next thing we need to do is, and I jokingly compare cybersecurity to proctology because number one, we're a specialty. We go beyond being a doctor. And then number two, we have to see everything, the good, the bad, and the ugly in order to manage risk, right? So once you do the vetting process and then you sign NDAs, we need to get in there and we need to see everything. We need to see how the network's configured, how everything's subnetted, how their ACLs are set up, how the firewalls are set up, what their policies are like, anything and everything. We need to see it all.
When it comes to training employees, when it comes to developing safety procedures, and when it comes to developing these drills that you talk about, how much of that should be communicated in the RFP that, you know, we as an end user expect you to provide this training for us, to create these drills for us, et cetera?
That should definitely be communicated in the RFP. And the beautiful part is that none of those procedures have to be written from the ground up. All these things all exist. There's a bunch of different frameworks. I like to, my go-to first is the DoD frameworks like the STIGs and the NISPOM because they're the most stringent and the most secure. And we can't always implement those in a business because it would just cost too much money. It would be great if we could, but that's not reasonable, right? But then beyond some of those DoD resources, a lot of these things are publicly available, by the way, if you know where to look. For instance, like the Defense Security Service website, there's a ton of stuff on there. And I don't think the people generally look at that. And then beyond that, you have things like NIST, and then you have ISO. And then PCI is not a good framework, but there's some things in there that could be used. So you don't have to rewrite any of this stuff. You could just get the policies from NIST or from ISO and then kind of adopt them to your own enterprise.
Eventually, odds are some sort of attack is going to happen, or at least be attempted on the company. In the RFP process, what should the end user, what kind of language should the end user put in there about, you know, here's what we expect from you if and when an attack occurs? And more than that, what should they expect from their provider if and when an attack occurs?
Well, there needs to be a written incident response plan as part of the entire program. And the incident response, again, goes back to like what I was saying earlier, the safety and the security going hand in hand, right? If you have a fire alarm goes off, you know exactly what to do. And the same should be true of some type of, a cyber incident. If somebody gets malware on their computer or they get ransomware, they should know, okay, well, I have to unplug it from the network and then notify the security manager immediately. That's my incident response. That's the first step is notification. And then when we look at, really, we need to just assume for a given enterprise, it doesn't matter what it is nowadays, we either have to assume that it's been breached or it's going to be breached, right, at some point in time. Because at the end of the day, if a state-backed actor, you know, for instance, China and the APT-10 effort, an APT-10 harkens back to the days of Titan Rain, it's an earlier effort, if they want to get into your system in order to obtain some kind of intellectual property or financial data or something like that, they're going to get in eventually. If they think the data is valuable enough, they might even be willing to blow a zero-day exploit on your enterprise. Zero-day exploits cost tens of thousands of money, tens of thousands of dollars. So again, like I said, when it comes to managing your risks, you just have to assume that you've either been breached or you're going to get breached at some point. And then you have to structure all of your policies and your technology accordingly.
My last question is around black hat and white hat experts that companies can hire to test their security. Do IT providers utilize this? Do you recommend hiring these types of experts? Where do you fall sort of in on that side of things, of having your network tested after building it?
Well, I'll tell you what, in the DoD, if you look in the security technical implementation guides, and again, these things are all public, vulnerability scans are supposed to be conducted every single month. PCI, I think, calls for them quarterly, but regular vulnerability scanning should definitely be done. And there's a bunch of different ways to do it, and there's a lot of sharks in the water that are selling those services, so you have to, you know, look at that too. And I'll give you an example of why. Let's hypothetically say that China, they got into your network and they didn't really find anything interesting. that they don't want. They're not going to just leave. What they're going to do is they're going to leave some type of a toehold in your network, a toehold in your network. And what that could be is some service listening on some port, and it's not going to be one of the standard ports of 0 through 1024. They're going to bind some service listening on port 49,534, right? So you need to regularly scan these things, normally outside of business hours, using probably Nessus or OpenVAS, Alienware. There's a whole bunch of them that do these types of automated scans. After business hours, you're going to want to scan all of your assets for vulnerabilities, ideally, really, at least once every 30 days. When I worked on classified networks, I used to do them every week, which was a huge pain in the butt, but that's what we did. And then you could review these things when they're finished, but definitely have a regular program to scan for vulnerabilities. Do it at least probably monthly, I think, is best. And then going beyond that, the second part of your question, I think, talks to active exploitation. So if we find a vulnerability in our system, we could move on to active exploitation, which means we might deliver some type of a payload to it. And really, it's up to the business owner or the management of the enterprise or the CIO or whoever to decide whether they want to accept the risk of doing something like that or not. Active exploitation can have all kinds of unforeseen consequences. It can break things. You don't really know what's going to happen. So in my mind, those are two different activities, vulnerability scanning and then active exploitation. They're both components of penetration testing, but they're definitely different phases.
Should the service provider that an end user hires, should they be taking care of this, or should it just be the end user works with the service provider to, you know, choose the right automated programs or choose the right, you know, third party to do these tests?
It should definitely be a third party who's disinterested and is not going to become acclimated to it per se. In the cybersecurity space, we call that separation of duties. You want to have a third, it's kind of like auditing, like you do in the financial space, but you want to have a third party doing those vulnerability scans. You could do them internally, but if you do them internally, the person that actually does the vulnerability scans and then the person that reviews the vulnerability scans have to be two different people in order to make sure that somebody is not, that's in order to help you mitigate the insider threat. You would need a separation of duty. So I would say the service provider should do the vulnerability scans from the outside on a regular basis and then provide the results to the customer so the customer can decide what they want to do. And of course, they're going to make recommendations.
Jason, that's a ton of extremely important information that I know my audience is going to get a lot of mileage out of. So thank you so much for joining us. If anyone in our audience wants to reach out to hire you or just to ask questions, things like that, let them know the area that you service and how to get in touch.
Our website is www.strongholdcybersecurity.com. All the contact information is right on the front there above the fold, info@strongholdcybersecurity.com. And then the phone number is right there. The immediate area that we would serve is central Pennsylvania and then northern Maryland. But beyond that, we could really service the entire Mid-Atlantic, or if circumstances warrant, then we could really come out to a customer anywhere. When it comes to highly specialized services like ours, that's not uncommon to fly out to a customer. And I'll leave you with one last thing here. The reason that I started this company was to take this knowledge that I learned working in these deep, dark, secure environments and then kind of bring that sort of culture of security to small businesses and MSPs, to bring that kind of industrial grade security like you find at Lockheed Martin or the Pentagon or the White House or wherever, and then help small businesses kind of implement some of these same sort of things.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that the customers really appreciate that. And I think that, you know, you can't go wrong with someone who has been in three of the 10 least likely places that you'll ever be allowed to visit on the planet. So Jason McNew,
yeah,
founder and CEO.
I can't tell you what they are either.
That's okay. That's okay. We won't get it out of you. I'll wait until we're off the record to ask that. Jason McNew, founder and CEO, Stronghold Cybersecurity. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay. Hey, thanks. It was great talking to you.
Thank you for listening to My Tech Decisions podcast. Here at Tech Decisions, it's our mission to help you do your job better. If you'd like to learn more, head over to www.techdecisions.co or follow us on Twitter at My Tech Decisions. I'm your host, Jonathan Blackwood, managing editor of Tech Decisions, and you can find me at BlackwoodTweets. Thanks for listening, and good luck on your installations and implementations.